Welcome to We The Podcast, the show about people outside the millionaire and billionaire class, you know, most of us, and how we interact with the economy. This week, we're talking about market concentration, how huge corporations control entire sectors of our economy without having to compete, and why it matters to you. Yes, you. You know, back in the old days, if two or three companies controlled an entire industry, we understood that this would make it hard for small businesses to break into the market. It would make it difficult on competition and even consumer choice. We wrote antitrust laws that restricted corporations for cornering the market and trying to engage in anti-competitive behavior, using their size to keep out the competition, stop choice, and limit people's opportunity. These antitrust laws are still on the books and are among the strongest antitrust and anti-monopoly laws in the world. Then, in the early 1980s, our government decided to stop enforcing anti-monopoly laws. From that point forward, we saw mergers that consolidated entire industries into the hands of a few. As a result, our economy is ruled by monopoly power. There is only a handful of big banks that control our entire financial sector. Our beverage industry is controlled by a few massive corporations. And our telecom industry is ruled by just four or five companies. And companies like Walmart and Google and Amazon have such a tight grip on the marketplace that they essentially do not have to compete. This week I'm talking to Barry Lynn, author of the book Cornered, and one of the foremost experts on monopoly power in this country. Barry doesn't keep it all high in the sky. Barry breaks it down so everybody can understand why having these big monopolies in all these industries across the entire economy is a bad thing and really needs change. He wants you to know about it. Barry, why don't you introduce yourself?
I'm Barry Lynn, and I direct the Open Markets Institute, which is a new organization because recently the Open Markets Program was part of the New America Foundation. But we got kicked out for taking on Google.
So apparently Google called up the leadership of New America and said that all this talk about market concentration wasn't something they wanted to see, and given that they had been giving money, that they should get what they want. Is that pretty much the story?
That, if you distill it down, that is the story. And it wasn't just me that got kicked out. It was my whole team. There was, depending on how you count us, there was about eight people that were shown the door. And this includes Zephyr Teachout, includes Phil Longman, who last year was a commissioner on the Veterans Affairs Commission. It included four people in their 20s. And we all got shown the door. We were given 2 months to get out. And we got out, and now we're up and running, and we are independent, and we are not going to take any more corporate money to make sure that no one's going to stop us from continuing with this fight.
What does it mean if a corporate giant can give a charitable donation, a donation which is supposed to be for the public good, and then call up the recipient of that donation and then direct the outcome and the content of research? What does that mean? And what if they can do it to a lot of folks because they give a lot of money?
Well, that means that the research that you read, the articles that you read, become doctored. The articles and the information that is being generated by people in think tanks, by people in academia, even by journalists, it becomes suspect. It becomes altered. It becomes manipulated by this exercise of power by a large corporation. It means the public actually starts to lose the ability to understand what's really going on in our society.
Well, you know, I read your book, Cornered. It's a great book. I recommend it. But let me just ask you this. You know, what was your main point in Cornered? And, you know, what is antitrust? What is anti-monopoly legislation? And, you know, why do we have it?
Yeah, so the main point that I was making in Cornered is that we have a really, really big monopoly problem in America today. You know, as you said, you know, this is probably the worst concentration we have ever seen in the United States. It's worse than the Gilded Age.
And the Gilded Age was back in the 1890s or so?
1890s, up through the first decade of the 20th century, you know, a little more than 100 years ago. This is the time of the plutocrats. And, you know, the plutocrats pretty much ran the country back then.
They're back.
They are sure back, and these guys got tools that the last group of plutocrats did not have.
I wish they had.
Oh yeah, these guys have spy devices. They have the ability to track what you're doing and see where you're going, and this is something that no plutocrat back in the old days ever had.
But at that time there also was a response to the market concentration. You had a president like Theodore Roosevelt. You had the Progressive Movement, which made anti-monopoly a cornerstone of their work. Do you see any movement today sort of pushing back against this market concentration that we see so prevalent?
Yes. I mean, we see the movement sort of breaking out right now. It's been, people were really quiet for a long time. People just didn't see the problem. But just in the last year, we've seen all kinds of movement here in Washington, but also across the United States. It's, for the first time, I've been doing this for a long time. I've been studying concentration for 20 years and the ills of concentration. And, now over the last year, for the first time, I see real movement.
So here are two related questions. How bad is it, and what are the ills of concentration?
Well, I'll do the second one first, and it's like we've been taught for the last generation to say, oh, well, concentration is bad for me as a consumer. It means higher prices. It means less choice, and that's true. It does mean higher prices. It means less choice. But the real fundamental ills of concentration of power, concentration of control, is a loss of liberty. It's the loss of our ability to, say, get a new job when I wanted to get a new job. Mm-hmm. I become captured by my employer. What it also means is the subversion of our democracy. When a few people control all of the wealth and when they control the main levers of power in our economy, they control our country. We do not have a democracy if we allow this kind of concentration of power. Liberty, democracy, that is what is now under threat.
Could you tease that out a little bit? I mean, how do the plutocrats, I'm talking about the big concentrated business leaders, how do they manipulate our democracy?
Well, they manipulate our democracy through the investment of money. They manipulate, in campaigns.
It's campaign donation.
That's right, campaign donations and just
lobbying.
Lobbying choosing which candidates get to run, but also just, basically setting the table in Washington, determining what the agenda is going to be, what are we going to talk about and what are we not going to talk about. This is actually with us. I mean, we were at New America when Open Markets was there. We were trying to shine a light on the ways that Google and other platform monopolies, we're not only an anti-Google shop, we're an anti-monopoly shop. So we were looking at how a number of companies are misusing their power, and we got booted. And that's one of the ways that these corporations, these powers, subvert our democracy. It becomes impossible for us to actually have open debate.
So they set the terms of conversation. I can tell you this, Barry, as a member of Congress, so much of what gets discussed around here is driven by this or that think tank, quite frankly. I mean, and if the think tanks are like, hey, we don't talk about monopoly, we don't use the M word, then that topic is less likely to be on the lips of people around here.
No, that's absolutely right. And we've been tracking this for a long time, and we really were, for a very long time, the only people that used the M word.
Monopoly.
Yes.
I said it.
And but this year, we now have other groups that are working with us. We have friends at CAP. We have friends at Roosevelt.
Center for American Progress.
The Roosevelt Institute. We have friends over even in Brookings now.
All right.
And so this, we have friends on the Republican side who are starting to understand that this isn't a game anymore. This isn't a matter of just like enriching my friends. This is what we're playing for now in this country is the preservation of our democracy and our most fundamental liberties.
Well, you got some good friends on the Dem side. I mean, you got Elizabeth Warren. Well, she's been very vocal on this issue. Hank Johnson over here has been great. Ro Khanna has been on this issue. And even little old me has been talking about this issue a little bit. So do you sense that there are more members of Congress willing to talk up on this issue of cartels, monopoly, market concentration?
No, absolutely. The change from, say, 2 years ago is fantastic. I can't say that we are on the verge of actually having a fix here to this problem, but the first step to fixing the problem is seeing the problem, and the second step is speaking about the problem. And we now have a bunch of brave leaders in Congress, in the Senate, who are talking about this. And that's what helps the American people understand that we have a problem and that we can fix it.
So I asked earlier, how bad is it? Could you give us an example? I mean, one tangible example came across my desk earlier this week with the whole Equifax scandal, with the loss of about maybe as many as 100 million, 140 million people's data. And then we find out that Equifax is in a market of about three biggies like themselves, and they all have these arbitration clauses, forced arbitration. So no matter what your losses are, you might well be not able to engage in a class action. You might not be able to, they will cap your damages. They will not give you, you can't sue, so you, there will not be any formal record of the proceedings. There won't be any discovery. So we won't get documentation out there that, you know, talks about it. And I, in my opinion, this is because Equifax has monopolistic power. They don't have to get better. They don't need to invest more money in data security, because if they don't, where are you going to go, right? They're kind of one of three games in town. Any thoughts on this?
No, I mean, you cut right to the core of the problem, which is when you're big, you just don't have to listen anymore. You tell other people what to do. That's the political problem in a nutshell. Just to understand, it's like what this means for the average person. It's okay if you're a consumer and your information was spilled out by Equifax. Well, that's too bad for you, isn't it? But it's not just affecting you as a consumer. This is something that affects people as workers, as labor, we see this with, there's this spread of non-compete agreements.
Right.
And this is, a non-compete means that you are not, okay, I'm working for this trucking company, or I'm working for this restaurant. And the company will say, well, if you want to work here, you have to sign this piece of paper. And it says that you can't go and work for another trucking company for the next 5 years. You can't work for another restaurant, you know, in this area, this town, for the next 5 years. That is a form of encerfment, of tying people to their corporate leaders, their corporate masters, that we have not seen in this country, certainly since the days of slavery. And this is something that with the founding of the nation was designed to precisely to begin the process of breaking this form of encerfment and enslavement.
You know what? I want to dig into that. But let me ask you this. They used to call stuff like that like restraint of trade, didn't they?
Yeah. No, I mean, when people founded the antitrust, when they federalized antitrust power in 1890, they talked about restraint of trade, but they understood the worker to be selling his or her labor.
Yeah.
So this was a sense of, every single person benefits, every producer, every farmer who's bringing a crop to market, every single innovator who is bringing an idea to market, every single person who is bringing labor to market. We want to have open and competitive markets to ensure that nobody gets to dictate what we earn to us, and that we have no bosses. We can pick up and leave. Walk across the street, walk down the way, and find a new person to sell our crop, our labor, or our idea to. That is what freedom is.
How many times do you see local communities pledging away their tax base so that some big, cartel or some, can come into their community, always with the dangling the promise of jobs? And that is what we're being offered, as opposed to fighting those big monopolists and saying, hey, we're going to create an environment where your own organic native talents can grow, where you can be creative and have low barriers to entry for your ideas. I kind of felt like that is something we see even nowadays.
Oh, absolutely. We're seeing it right now with Amazon. Amazon says, we're going to create a second headquarters. In this headquarters, we're going to employ, say, something like 30,000 people. So now what they have is just about every single city, every single town, every single state in this country is saying, well, we want your headquarters, your second headquarters here. And so now you see this race to give away things to Amazon so that they will come to a particular place. This happens very much today, and it's one of the things that makes it hard to concentrate power against the monopolists. But as you know, the key thing again is that what we want to do is like the way the political economy of the United States used to be structured. Following the principles of Brandeis and Wilson and FDR, is that it is to put the individual citizen and the individual community first. The corporation exists to serve the public. The business corporation exists to serve the individual, not vice versa.
Yeah, it's amazing. In this whole, post Citizens United world, some corporations are a person with a whole lot more rights than any person I ever met walking around. It's amazing. So, our country actually did, we're talking about like 1912, but we did develop a way to combat and confront monopoly and cartel. And you invoked FDR, and we actually were pretty good. There was a case, I think you mentioned the A&P case, where we were kind of on the alert for the monopoly for a while, and then things changed. Can you talk about the golden age of anti-monopoly enforcement in the United States a little bit?
Yeah, the golden age, we really had two golden ages, and the first was in the early days of the Republic when things were kept small, and people kept them small because you didn't have major technologies linking up place and place. You didn't have railroads, you didn't have telegraph, you didn't have, now the internet. So it was relatively easy to fight monopoly. The second stage came in the early 20th century, in the mid 20th century, when we were adjusting our laws to deal with the rise of the railroad and airplanes and the telephone and these technologies that crushed space. It was essentially a second American Revolution because, as we've talked about before, the plutocrats during the Gilded Age had concentrated control in their own hands. They had all the levers of power in this country in their own hands. And the American people, over the course of about 20 years, broke the power of the plutocrats. They broke the power of the corporate barons. They broke the power of the giant bankers and financiers, and they returned the power to the people. And that was what existed in this country. That was that's how this country was run up until the early days of the Reagan administration. And that's when things really radically changed.
Yeah, but then what happened during Reagan, and who were some of the thought leaders that helped to bring about the change?
Yeah, so what happened in the, and this is important for people to understand, is in the early days of the Reagan administration, there was a bunch of folks who came from the Chicago School of Economics. And these people said, you know what? We've been using antitrust, anti-monopoly to protect our liberty. We've been using it to protect our democracy and our communities. But you know what? It's inefficient the way we use our anti-monopoly. So we should change it so that we can promote greater efficiency in the creation of stuff. And they changed the philosophy behind our anti-monopoly laws. And they said, rather than serving the citizen, the interest of the citizen, and the citizen wants, what does the citizen want? The citizen wants liberty. The citizen wants democracy. They said, what we need to do is promote the interest of the consumer. And what does the consumer want? The consumer wants stuff. So they literally went in and crossed out the word citizen from the laws that we use to protect us against monopoly. And they said, and they wrote in instead the word consumer, consumer welfare. And in doing that, they changed how all of this whole body of anti-monopoly law that we had developed over 200 years in this country, at a stroke, they changed the philosophy of how we enforce those laws, and they turned anti-monopoly law into a means to create monopoly.
And yeah, and so what have we seen since then? I mean, was Robert, because I understand, was one of the leading voices in this area.
Yes, Robert Bork wrote a book. He published this book called The Antitrust Paradox. He published it in 1978, and that was the book that the Chicago scholars, that the Reagan administration used to as their primer, as their guide for overthrowing these laws that we had used to preserve our liberty and preserve our democracy for 200 years. And Bork was, he was, there were a few other folks that were engaged in that battle. There were actually some people, just to be honest, there were some people from the, there's the command, we could call it the command and control left, who kind of said amen to that. But actually,
there was a famous case in which the deciding opinion was actually the great Justice Brennan, who kind of used some judicial language to open the door for greater monopolization as well.
Yeah, and the thing is, the important thing for people to understand is that laws exist within a framework of ideas, and that you can take the same laws and you can use them in radically different ways depending on what kind of governing ideas you have in your head. And the thing about sort of Chicago School libertarianism, it is a way of thinking that is designed to hide truth from you. Where, instead of, for 200 years, people would see, well, they've concentrated power. I see a fist in my face. What the Chicago School libertarian ideology is designed to do is to hide that fist behind something that they call the market.
Right.
But the result is that for the last 35 years, we've seen the other side steadily concentrate more power in that fist. And that's the reality we face today, is that on our side, there's a whole bunch of folks who are standing here ready to fight, but we don't quite know how. On the other side, they have a very fat, clenched fist.
Well, that's actually an important point. I mean, one of the things that got me interested in this idea of market concentration is the idea that when people say like one of my heroes, Elizabeth Warren, says the economy is rigged. Well, what does she mean by that? Of course, there's some sense that big business people giving checks out to members of Congress, getting things all nice and cushy for themselves, sort of is kind of what that's about. But monopoly is implicated in that.
Yeah, actually, here's an example of how the economy got rigged, or, of what it means. Back in the early 1950s, there was this guy named Sam Walton, and he came to this town called Bentonville in the middle of Arkansas. And in Bentonville, there were four different general stores in this little town. And he had just enough money to put down, to buy a lease on one of those stores. And he went into business, and he was good at it. And he was able to use his, the money he made running that business to put food on the table and a roof over his family's head. Now, the reason he was able to go into that store, into Bentonville, that town, and buy a store, that was by design. That was because of the way we had structured the laws in this country, beginning under President Wilson, continuing under President Roosevelt, we structured the laws to ensure that Sam Walton had that opportunity. He had that liberty to do that. Today, because 35 years after the change that was put in place by the Chicago scholars, by Robert Bork, people no longer have that opportunity. Pretty much two companies control retail in this country, Walmart and Amazon. There's a few others around the edges, but they're fast being squashed.
Well, now that you're on that topic, Barry, let's just kind of go there. There's retail, which is highly concentrated. But also, let's just say you want to find something out that you don't know. Or even if you want to find out what the latest showings are at the movie you want to see this weekend. Say you use a search engine. How many choices you got there?
Well, you really just have one. I mean, the folks from Google will say, oh, we got choice. You know, you can go over to Bing. But anyone who sort of moves back and forth between Bing and Google knows that Google has collected more information, that their searches are, because there's more people using it on a day-to-day basis, the search works better. So this is a case in which the nature of the technology result, it tends to result in concentration of people going to one place. So, for all intents, I mean, as you're pointing out, there really isn't any real choice if you want a sophisticated search. You got to go to Google.
Yeah, well, you got Google, you got Yahoo, you got Microsoft, you got Bing, you got DuckDuckGo. And one thing about Google is that they will actually keep and then sell your search, the information you search on, you know?
Yeah. And in many ways, it's like they say this is our private information. We collected this information. This is our business. But in many ways, think about that information that they've collected. This is information about you. It's the information about how you've been living your life, what you've been searching for, what you've been buying, what you've been thinking, what you've been reading.
They even know how long the mouse wavers over a particular product you might want to buy online. I mean, you know, and by the way, I contest the idea that that's their information.
It's our information. It's my personal information, and collective, when you put it into a big pile, it is the public information. This is the information about what the public is doing.
Right.
So there have been various times in this country when we've had cases in which we said, all that information that you've put behind your wall, okay, maybe you've stored all of the grain in a particular part of this country in your silo. Well, you have to tell us, the public, how much grain is in that silo so we know you are not speculating on the knowledge that you're gaining from how much grain is in your silo.
So you can't corner the market.
So you can't corner the market. You can't manipulate us. You can't sort of do with us what you will, and that is our information, and we are going to have it. So one of the things that we should be thinking about in this country right now is saying, hey, all that information that Google is gathering about what we're searching, also where we're driving, you know, through their Google Maps and Waze, that's our information. That is public information. That is information that belongs to us, and they have put it behind their walls, and we need to get it back.
But I mean, like, if you just look at, so we just talked about search engines, but if you want to go to do business in the arcade, food, and entertainment business, you know, about two companies control about 96%. That's CEC Entertainment Inc. and Dave and Buster's. They pretty much divided up. After that, if you just want to get like paper products, you know, you got Kimberly Clark, you got Procter & Gamble, you got Georgia Pacific. They kind of divided up into thirds. Those three got about 90%. Wireless telecommunication carriers, four. You got Verizon, AT&T, Sprint, and T-Mobile. They got about 94%. Satellite providers. You want to go get satellite? You call them DirecTV or Dish Network. What about getting a Coca-Cola? We call it pop where I'm from. But you're dealing with Coke, you're dealing with, look what I just said, Coca-Cola, right? But you're dealing with Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or Dr. Pepper, Snapple. I mean, I could go on and on. Is this a good way to run an economy? And does it have to be this way?
Well, some people do say it is a good way to run this economy, and they've actually won the debate for the last 35 years. I think it's now increasingly evident that it is a terrible way to run the economy. It crushes opportunity. It chokes off growth. It results in fewer jobs. It results in lesser jobs. It results in lower wages. The key thing is, I mean, in many cases, see, what you just said, you mentioned these various sectors in which two or three companies control everything.
Yeah.
But the thing, it's actually worse than that often, because these companies then engage in cartel behavior. They chop up the country into different regions.
Right.
They say, you know what, you go take care of business there, and I'll take care of business here. So even though it looks like there's two companies, it looks like there's three companies, it's actually where you are, it's often just one company.
Sure. And, well, you made the point when it comes to autos, you know, that it may look like three companies, but it's only one because they all engage the same supplier network. They have abandoned vertical integration, and they just kind of buy from the same people. So if you got a flaw in the supplier, then the flaw could end up in all three brands.
Yeah, and that's a fantastically important point. Is, you know, we're talking about concentration, you know, how it harms us politically, how it harms us economically, how it harms us as workers and as consumers. The other problem with concentration is that the complex systems that we depend on, the financial system, the banking system, the industrial system, when there's concentration in those systems, it makes those systems fragile. It makes those systems subject to cascading crashes. Some of you will remember the term too big to fail, which we applied to the banks back at the time of the bailout in 2008, 2009. What is too big to fail? It's when you allow the few to concentrate their risk. And by concentrating their risk, it allows them to socialize the risk because someone has to bail them out when things go wrong, because otherwise all of society suffers.
Well, you know, a thing about that too is that you know, we passed a law that said that if you're too big to fail, then you would be designated as a strategically important financial institution, a SIFI. And they are complaining about being called SIFIs. And there's an answer. If you don't want to be a SIFI, you can just break up and downsize. But we really don't see that happening. They're too busy trying to lobby Congress.
Oh, you know, if you got, that's the thing about monopoly profits. You know, if you got, there are some theories that say that if you get monopoly profits, you reinvest them in innovation. I, in all of my time studying this, have seen that very, very rarely. If you got monopoly profits, what you invest them in is buying power.
Yeah, you buy, yeah, that's an interesting commodity around here in Congress.
It's a lot cheaper than buying innovation.
Well, you know, isn't that interesting? So that one, is that one of the effects of market concentration, that there's just more return on investment to just try to get a tax cut than just to go try to make something new and helpful to people?
I mean, one of the things that we have seen is the profits of large corporations in the United States are greater than they have ever been.
And there's some.
And meanwhile, it's like, we think that there's a lot of innovation in this country, but actually if you look closely, depending on what sector you're looking at, you can go from sector to sector to sector to sector, in which you just see the same basic technologies that we have seen in use for 30, 40, 50 years. There is a, and this is true in really important areas, including like drugs and healthcare. We were being told that there was innovation, but when you look at the numbers, you don't see a lot of innovation reflected in the real numbers.
Well, I mean, if you like, just take a look at like bottled water. You might just go say, "Oh, I'm thirsty. I'm gonna get some bottled water." Basically, that's three companies, right? You got Coke, you got Nestle, and you got Pepsi, right? Those are the three that make the bottled water. And yet but when people think of it, they look on the in the refrigerator at the place you're going to sell buy water, and they may have 20 different brands. How does that happen?
Yeah, this is one of the things is, you know, I wrote about this in my book. It's, you know, I call it the illusion of choice.
Right.
And Americans, you know, we walk around, we go into the store and we see all these different brands and all these different prices. And we think, you know, it's like, oh, you know, we study the choices each week and we try and like make, you know, I grew up in a family, we clipped coupons. We had a real tight budget. We were poor for a period of time. So we made, you know, we spent a lot of time making sure that we made wise decisions when we bought things. People do that. That's what smart people do. You know, it's like, that's what, but the fact is, when you go to to many parts of the store, there's really just one choice. You're seeing actually a bunch of different brands, but they're all owned by one company. Or maybe they're owned by two companies, but those two companies are in cahoots, and they are working together to set prices.
So, Barry, what do you think the future holds here? I mean, you know, if you were going to recommend a few things that you'd like to see happen, What are some ideas that we might work on to try to deconcentrate markets and give innovative entrepreneurs a shot, increase consumer choice, get some price competition. What do you think we might do?
Well, I think the first thing that all of us have to do, because we have been trained for the last generation, two generations, to see ourselves as consumers. And this is, you know, there's this is something, you know, as I mentioned before, it's been written in the law that we are not citizens anymore in the political economy. We are consumers in the political economy. So the very first thing that every one of us can do is say, you know, I'm not going to think of myself as a consumer anymore. I'm not going to think about, is this concentration of power resulting in lower prices like they're promising me? It's like, but think of yourself as a citizen. And think of as a citizen, what is the primary thing you want out of the political economy? What you want is freedom to sell whatever it is that you have to sell, your labor, your ideas, your crops. You want the freedom to go and sell those at a fair price. And if you end up driving up the amount of money that you earn from your work, that will more than make up if any of these prices actually go up. And the fact is, real competition will result in lower prices. Mm-hmm. So we will have higher wages and lower prices if we think of ourselves as citizens and say, I want a market structure that serves me as a citizen. That's, you know, number one. But, you know, you asked us, like, you know, what do I see in the future? And I believe with all of my heart, I know that we are going to be victorious in this, the American people. I mean, this is a tough time we're in. This is an amazing amount of power that is concentrated in front of us. But the thing is, as someone sort of opens their eyes to this this concentration of power, what we have is we have all of the wisdom of the American people built up over 200 years in this vast array of law and policy on how to regulate competition among ourselves to ensure that we produce every year more to share with each other. Real productive, constructive competition, we know how to do it. We have models that were built up over time, all kinds of laws that we can sort of reinstitute right now, update for the digital 21st century. We've did this for 200 years. We know how to do it. And we just, as soon as we wake up, we will know how we can move forward and take on these powers.
We did beat back the plutocrats once before.
Absolutely. I mean, people talk about the first American Revolution. We have to remember, this is a little bit of hidden history. There was a second American Revolution, and now going forward, we are going to have our third.
Yeah, thanks for tuning in to listen to Barry Lynn and I talk about market concentration. I'm going to leave you with this thought. Be a citizen, not just a consumer. Citizens are moral agents. They think about what's good and bad, what's right and what's wrong. Consumers don't think about these things. They think about what's cheaper, what's more fun, what they can buy. As a citizen, you need to operate on a certain level of uncertainty. You don't know how the election is going to turn out. You don't know if fighting City Hall is going to turn out for the good or the bad. You do it because it's right. You have to operate on hope and hope that your engagement, your participation, and your vote will make a difference. Consumers, on the other hand, operate on certainty. The certainty that you're going to get your money's worth, that the brand you trust will give you what you want, and that you're getting the product that you want. Consumers don't have to take chances, but guess what? Citizens take chances all the time. Consumers operate in their own self-interest and only their self-interest. All they want to do is get more for themselves, please themselves, you know, shinier teeth, fresher breath. That's all consumers care about. Citizens, on the other hand, think about what's best for the neighborhood, the city, the community, and the nation. It's time for us to think about ourselves as citizens, as self-conscious agents of our nation's best interests. Not just what can you get cheaper, or what's the new flavor, or what's the new whatever you can buy. Real citizenship requires something much deeper than that. For We the Podcast, this has been Keith Ellison. And don't forget to go to iTunes, rate, review, and subscribe right away. This has been another episode of We the Podcast, and it was produced by Zach Freed.